Hi, and welcome to another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. Today, my guest is Ross Dawson, whom I've known for many years, and he is a world-renowned keynote speaker, strategy advisor, and entrepreneur, and all-round smart, nice person. Welcome, Ross.
Pleasure to be here, Kate.
So, I think we're going to have an interesting chat about AI. So, what's got you really passionate about AI at the moment?
Well, for me, this is sort of a masterful invention of humanity, but we have to be looking at it how it is complements humanity. So this framework of humans plus AI, how can humans and AI work together? So my lens on AI is always around how can this augment humans? How can this increase our capabilities to do the things we want to do, taking that stance. And essentially there are, if we look at cognition, this idea of, taking in information, making sense of it, and being able to, take useful actions as a result, that the human cognition and, broadly what we can sort of AI cognition are quite distinct and highly complementary. So I look at the spectrum of decisions which we need to make. And some of them are very, very low level, which can be data-based. So there's a lot of, I mean, the classic one is your credits, small credit lending decision or fraud detection or things like that. These are ones where you have lots of data and you can make an effective decision around, whether to proceed or whether to flag something or so on. Through to the more complex ones, which is what should I do with my life? Or should we make this strategic acquisition or things like that, where essentially human intake of data and processing of that is more effective. But bringing those together, we can look at what are either AI first decisions, where we can use a whole array of wonderful techniques that have been developed over the years for essentially processing lots of data to be able to predict effectively and make useful decisions. And the far broader context in which humans work, and where we have human first decisions, which are incredibly complex, involve human and ethical issues, and not ones which you would necessarily entrust to AI as it stands today, but where AI can play an extraordinarily valuable role in supporting or complementing or augmenting the decision-making process.
So, could you perhaps explain for us just what you're talking about? So, I think you were basically talking about things like machine learning for those automated decisioning processes, where we want to know have you got a good enough credit score to do this, up to what are the other kinds of AI technologies that you're talking about?
I mean, I have the sort of a, it is simplistic, but I think it is very useful to distinguish between, what I call analytic AI, or some people call traditional AI, or good old boring AI, and generative AI. And of course, there are a lot of overlaps between them. But one of the most important distinctions between them, to my mind, is that machine learning is essentially domain bounded. It takes in data where you have some parameters around what that data is. So if you have credit data, you're not going to throw in the price of fish or whatever it might be.
One hopes not, yeah.
Yes, you've got to do some data cleansing on the way to make sure you do have the appropriate set. Which in fact goes to that point. We do need data cleansing. We do need to be able to have the right data and to train machine learning, which is useful. And so, but that is always domain bounded. And so if we're looking at predictions, and that's, AI has traditionally often been described as a prediction machine, and it can be very effective, but that's always within a specific domain. Whereas generative AI is unbounded. So it's trained, essentially on all scraps of content that humanity has created that they can
Yeah, it can do
pull
surprising
together.
things. It can do unpredictable things.
Yes. And but it's there's you can look at any domain. You could go, have conversations or engage with a generative AI system or a broadly trained LLM on any topic you choose and just hop about wherever you want. And machine learning is completely distinct because it is bounded. So whilst there are a number of different, distinctions between the machine learning and the, traditional AI or analytic AI, since there's a lot of related techniques in there. And so that's where you have to have specific data sets for machine learning, domain bounded training. And generative AI, you have unlimited data sets. And part of the magic which happens in those is that, it does pay attention to the relevant pieces so that we can find what is useful and pertinent to us.
And how do you see RAG models, retrieval augmented generative models, playing into that?
Well, essentially, those are essentially generative AI techniques because these are still content. There's, say text or a whole variety of other domains, and it's simply been able to use, well, essentially the large language model type techniques to be able to retrieve those, building some structure around them. And I think, the whole rise of vector databases is absolutely critical in being able to build the embedding the relationships between all of the information so you can pull this out in a meaningful way. So, essentially flat search, as it was with, the Googles and a lot of the old enterprise search, was find a text string in this bunch of data. And, whilst that some of those algorithms improved a little bit over the years, it's a completely different thing is when that data is structured in vectors where you can actually implicitly identify the relationships between the, the tokens or the elements within that data so that you can find what's relevant.
This sounds as if it's though it sounds as what you're talking about is kind of going against what a lot of people have been talking about is that generative AI is working over largely unstructured data. You're saying we need to structure the data again to drive this. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, well, well,
I
the
love it
process,
because you know
LLMs, the
don't
training of
you?
LLMs essentially does implicitly build up. It is the embeddings which is overlaid on all of the ingested data starts to provide these kinds of structures which make it more useful. And so a couple of layers above that is where you can start to build knowledge graphs and ontologies. And the ontologies, which could describe anything from understanding a domain of medicine through to the ch structure of a supply chain, is something where essentially you do need some human oversight. So, what is the actual meaning of the relationship between a part number and the location of where the refrigerators it applies to go? And so this starts to become. There are layers from essentially the embeddings which are implicit in the processing of data ingested into LLMs to building more structures, knowledge graphs, and ontologies where you do have some direction to make sure they are as useful as possible in being able to pull out what is meaningful and relevant.
You've really cheered me up because, you know, I've had a grand passion for graph databases for a very long time, and I think they're coming into their own now, which is really
Oh,
nice.
yes. Well, I mean, my most successful LinkedIn post of this year, with 1,500 likes or whatever, is we started off saying ontology may be the word of the year, and then described a little bit why, and just everyone's people are recognizing that it is building the structure of relationships between data.
Yeah, but not in a relational database because that's very costly to do searches on, for example.
Yeah, well, also essentially relational is, essentially row column. So you don't have many parameters to play with in terms of mapping the relationships. Does it, you just have a couple as opposed to, the unlimited scope of a, essentially the embeddings, which look at the, whereas, and then one of the points being, embeddings look at a token level in terms of what are the, the proximity of different tokens. And thus, to be able to make the next token prediction through to the knowledge graphs or ontologies, which refer to higher levels, which is not just a phoneme or something within a word, but something which is meaningful, such as a drug or
Yeah,
a part or a
which kind of sounds a lot like what people are talking about using RAG models for that higher order understanding. So that's really interesting. I wanted to dig into the human side of it because one of the things that people are often talking about how AI is going to take all the people out of the loop all of the time, and I kind of don't really like that idea because I like your idea of it being augmentative of humanity, not replacing us, except where we want it to for boring stuff. I'm all for replacing us for boring stuff.
Well, I mean, I think there's two aspects to that. One is part of it is through design, if we aim to automate humans out of work, then that's more likely to happen. But I think we can design it in a way which does amplify our humanity and creating the work that you want to work. But in fact, I actually think that work will be destroyed at a far, far, far slower pace than most pundits believe. And I'm pretty hard on the optimistic end of the spectrum. I did a little mini report earlier this year, which I call 13 Reasons to Believe in a Positive Future of Work. And, there's a, without going through them blow by blow, I think that not only do there are many jobs that are highly relevant to people, we are going to, we value what humans do. And there is so much of what humans do, which is actually not substituted for by AI. And so I think we, and the pace of change, it's how long have you been hearing about people saying, automation is going to destroy jobs? So we're still, biggest population in the world, lowest unemployment ever, just about. So it hasn't happened yet. And I don't see it coming too soon either. I just, there's a whole lot of structural ways of social, part of it is, social impetus and so on. But we are also just, we continue to create new roles, what it is we see people are useful for, to be able to make people more productive. And so I think one of the key things within organizations here is that, just hearing from somebody who's saying, people are frightened about things that can make them more productive because suddenly, well, they can do their job in half the time. Well, that's because you've got defined a job as a box. I've railed against this for a very, very long time. If you say, well, this is a box, here's a, let's find somebody that fits that box and we'll stick them in that. And then as soon as you automate it away, then you've, or part of it, then you've replaced person, as opposed to saying, here is a person who worked for us, who's amazing. And all sorts of ways that, we've discovered and we have yet to discover and they have yet to discover. And we can create an organization where we can amplify their productivity to do, unimaginably more value creating things than they ever did before.
And that's such an important thing. I was at a board dinner the other night with the chair of this AICD, and she was talking about how Australia's productivity problem. We've got a genuine productivity problem in this country. And the recent Australian government report on generative AI use, like Microsoft Copilot inside government, and all of the executives said that generative AI was really powering their work. It was helping them get through stuff more efficiently. And that's the kind of step change we need as a country, a productivity improvement across the board.
Yeah, and it takes a lot of things, and part of it, on a very crude level, it's like we need to design the system, the AI, whatever, so that it is usable and useful and complementary. And we also, of course, need the skills of humans to be able to use them well. And we also need to redesign organizations so that they're not saying, okay, well, here's some people, can we replace them or not? But here's an organization which we redesign, reconceive. As in, how can people and AI, create more value than they ever did before?
It's really fascinating because I'm going to be doing some work with a company that is literally redesigning all their processes around AI. And they had stuff that they did in the real world where they would leave the building and go out and do stuff. And now they don't need to do that. They can do it with AI. And so they're reinventing how their company works at a really fundamental level right now. Be in the next couple of weeks. So that's a really interesting, like they're obviously an early adopter in this space, but they've kind of seen the writing on the wall, and they reckon if they don't do this, they won't exist in a couple of years.
Yeah, well, there's some, and it depends on the industry, but some organizations are more challenged than others in terms of what their business model are. And within any industry, if you think that way, there's every you do have to be looking at how your adjacent companies are working. Are you moving as fast as them and being able to amplify your capabilities of taking your resources of people or assets or relationships, whatever, and creating value for customers. And that's going to shift so fast for the fast movers. But the thing is, there aren't that many fast movers. So It's actually not as hard as I think some leaders think to actually be reasonably somewhat ahead of the pace at least.
Well, I think it's just the traditional Christensen's innovator's dilemma. How do you innovate while keeping your cash cows alive? And you know, we've all faced that ever since I've been working, which is a very long time. You know, it's always been a challenge. And now it's just AI powered.
And so business model. So in fact, one of my core focuses right now is AI-driven business model innovation. So it's like saying, well, how does AI change business models and a whole array of factors from scalable efficiency to changing AI augmented products to being able to have AI as a customer to being able to, restructure value delivery to how it impacts platforms and ecosystems and all of these facets. So AI changes your business model, but it also gives you the opportunity to amplify and to accelerate your ability to innovate in your business models. And I think that every leader must be focused on business model first, saying your business model is changing. And it is a massive opportunity now to reframe what your business model could be and put that in practice.
That I think people are really struggling with, and people are asking me this a lot. You know, what kind of things should we do with AI? Like they don't even have a mental map to put the really low-hanging fruit, the operational efficiency, take the friction out of processes stuff, which is really kind of obvious to me and you, but they're not even understanding how they can even do that. Very basic stuff, let alone reconceptualize their business model.
Yeah, well, that's where we need the leaders, and it is frustrating, with this focus on cost efficiency. I mean, it's the easiest of all of those facets of how it is AI can impact your business. It's the easiest, the most obvious, but there's so many other ways in which it can be used to add value. And part of my broader thesis as well is that talent is going to be so important that those organizations that prioritize people in this shift and augment their people are going to be the ones where talent goes. And if leaders are kind of saying, oh, well, how can we cut costs, which, oh, that happens to be a headcount, I'm not going to find it as easy to attract the most talented people.
So what sort of roles do you see that'll be really essential in building this new kind of business with this augmented human AI?
Well, I did a framework on humans in the future of work in 2016, where I pointed to three sort of things of creativity and expertise and relationships and sort of and all of these things, the way they combined. And right in the very center of it, I put human-centered design. And AI can't do human-centered design. And every aspect of what we do is a design process. It's not just around customers. It is around the nature of what work is. It's the nature of how we interface with, the rest of reality. This is all a design thing. How are we making sure that we are, shifting things and moving things more towards things that are human focused and which as a result, more value creating? So I think this design in the very broadest sense, far beyond the way people most understand, design is in everything. It's in how we set up this conversation. It's in how, that's the whole nature of everything. So I think that's one critical piece. And there's an interesting point around this idea of translation in the sense of how can technologists be trans, communicate with business people is one of the most obvious ones. And there's a whole way of other translation things, or how can the product designer sort of reach the customers? Hopefully there's less of a translation piece there. There are so many facets of how we are facilitating communication, that merging of the minds. And again, sort of going back to big picture, I think of an organization as collective intelligence, or at least that's what it should be. This idea of, okay, well, it's got a bunch of individuals in it who hopefully are individually intelligent. And the measure is the organization collectively more intelligent or less intelligent than the sum of the parts? And the opportunity of clearly is that we can have collectively intelligent organizations where we can combine the insights and the capabilities and all of the facets of the people within them to be amplified to degrees which we, we've never yet reached. That's absolutely on the table.
That sounds like a delightful future. I look forward to it. One of the things that occurs to me, though, so what sort of things might one need to change in one's organization to start to realize that kind of future?
Culture. For starters.
You know that old saying, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Yeah.
I
Well,
worked at
the
one
culture.
company. I worked at one company 10 years ago, and then I went back 10 years later. The culture had not changed, even though they had spent millions of dollars trying to change the culture. So culture
Yeah.
is really resilient. I
It
said,
is. It is.
how do you shift?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't put my hand up and say I'm the change management expert, but I mean, ultimately it is in leadership. And, I think, two of the many dimensions of it. One is this of that we value human first. We value people as, whether they be customers or people on the street or people working there, that there is truly human and people focus. That's just kind of a fundamental thing. And if you haven't got that, that's you're not going to do as well as the organizations that do. That's one piece. And the other is experimentation and play, as in we're not there's nobody's got the this is in the box what you should need to do as an organization. You can look around, you can learn from others, but essentially the only way to do it is to be curious and to experiment and to play and to learn. So every this old, but I don't think trite, things that we have to be learning organizations now more than ever. Everything is moving faster and faster, and unless people want to learn and do learn and are
But
rewarded for learning.
that means that really organizations, if they want to be that kind of organization, then they need to start to think about how they're going to create a sense of psychosocial safety inside their organization so that it's okay to be wrong, it's okay to fail fast, it's okay to try new things. And that's a really important thing for people to understand. This is about innovation as a practice and AI as a tool. And if you understand that, and for that to be effective, you need to have that sense of psychosocial safety. And that's a thing that organizations are looking at now, which is really good.
Yeah, well, it's certainly explicit, as in say, yes, we do need to create psychological safety in organizations. There's lots of consultants helping to do that, but it just goes back to the intent. Do we prioritize people over, other things? And and again, I always believe there is not the conflict between the profit and whatever, social or environmental good, whatever you're seeking. That's the path to the greatest profits, as long as you have a more than 6 month time frame, is always to prioritize people, because that's going to get you to where you are the most successful organization.
Yeah, I love that. That's one of the things I've always loved about you. You always had that focus on people, and people making organizations stronger and stuff. So what would be your key takeaway for organizations? Like, what do they need to start to think about doing in the short term to be able to participate in this kind of future?
There's one of the it's capability development, as in every they're talking about the learning organization. All right, yes, we all need to learn, but it's saying, well, what are we going to become? This whole was it the Bob Dylan quote, he who is not busy being born is busy dying. And same thing for organizations, as in this continual reborn. And that's the way I When people say, "Well, what's innovation?" For me, it is the renewal. You must be continually renewing yourself, and so this requires this saying: what are the capabilities that matter? How can we get better at those capabilities? How do we learn as individuals? What are the processes we develop? How do we get our data infrastructure, decent? How do we get our data pipelines good? Because that's a pretty important part of it. It's nice. We're talking a lot at the very high levels, but you do need your data pipelines, your data infrastructure, your data architecture, is absolutely fundamental capabilities for all of this as well. And so you're saying, well, what are all these layers of capability development? Just saying, okay, it's a journey. We're not going to get there tomorrow or in a year, but we can see the direction. These are all the sets of capabilities we need to develop. Let's get busy developing those capabilities. And the best way to develop those capabilities is to do stuff, experiment, and learn by doing.
It's really interesting that you mentioned the data platforms and data pipelines, because I spent the last 5 years at UNSW building a data platform that could serve up traditional business intelligence and analytics, AI and ML, low code apps, and data integration. And I keep to people go, oh my God, you built all of that, it's amazing. Like, I haven't done that. Well, it's just start today. Like, it only happens if you start the journey. So take one step towards it.
Exactly.
So it's so fundamental. But now, one question I did want to ask you is, how do you think the different parts of the organization, like the board, the executive, and then the rest of the team, how do you see their roles in this area that's emerging?
Well, that's a interesting question. And I think there's, as I do a lot of work with boards, and I guess the dynamic between the executive and the board is, well, always interesting. And one of the key points is, where does strategy reside, in terms of framing the business models of the organization? And, there's different opinions and different debates around this, and obviously it needs to be co-created. And essentially, at its best, the board creates the conditions whereby the executive can do the hard work of being able to frame and to propose, the details of how it is we'll implement that, and to be able to push back and improve and refine and hopefully approve what is proposed. And so that's the board creates the frame within which the strategy innovation and business model innovation and the culture development and so on can happen. And so that's and there's a lot of hard work to be done below that. And one of the key points, of course, is diversity on every dimension that you can think of. And that includes, of course, in layers of the organization where frontline people, as well as board members, as well as executive team, as well as lots of layers in between, they all have different perspectives. And if you just have the board and the executive, you're not gonna have the diversity of perspectives you need.
So really, really some important points there. So this is a pretty good time to wrap up. Thank you so much for your time, Ross. It's been really great talking to you. Always a pleasure.
Fantastic talking with you, Kate.
And that is it for another episode of the Data Revolution podcast. I'm Kate Crothers. Thank you so much for listening. Please don't forget to give the show a nice review and a like on your podcast app of choice. See you next time.